welcome to a Big Beetle Sort Out special episode. You may recall that Paul previously spoke to the legal scholar Cass R. Sunstein in a special live interview at Liverpool University. Well, Cass has a new book coming out on the 21st of May called How to Become Famous, Lost Einsteins, Forgotten Superstars and How the Beatles Came to Be. It's published by Harvard Business Review Press. We caught up with him to discuss the book and the Beatles. Now, if you're not one of our regular listeners, after you listen to this, please check out some of our usual episodes. This series, we're going through all the UK number ones of the 1960s and ranking them for music, lyrics and production, while looking for how these were linked to the Beatles and the impact their story had on the musical landscape. So, please enjoy as we try to sort out, with Cass Sunstein, how to become famous.
Gary's prepared some questions here, but having read the book, I do want to just quickly throw something in at the start, and that's to say thank you for introducing me to Connie Converse, who I had never ever heard of, and listened to the album, the first one that was out in 2009 today, and it's just absolutely stunning.
Yeah, she's a hero of the book, and maybe in the fullness of time she will be iconic. I hope so.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she's a very good example of what your book's all about, really. The difference between opportunity champions, the information cascades and so forth. But before we get started on that, we're obviously here with a bit of a Beatles focus. So tell us a little bit about where the Beatles enter your life. So I don't want to give away your age too much, Cass, but you should probably have been about exactly the right age to be struck dumb by them in 1964 and onwards, you know, in America.
Well, I'm seeing the cover of Revolver even as we speak, and the first record I ever had was Revolver, and I thought it was amazing and incredible. And I was hooked after Revolver. It took me a while to have a knowledgeable basis for being hooked, but that was the start. And then I got Rubber Soul not long after, and I've Just Seen a Face, and that was a defining moment. And when Sgt. Pepper's came out, it was thrilling. And there was a record, as I remember, called Meet the Beatles, I think that's the name of it, that was only produced in the UK, and it at the time it might have had a different name, and it found its way to Massachusetts, and I got a copy of it, and I felt like I had struck gold.
Yeah, it must be interesting. Entry points are always very interesting with the Beatles. Coming in at Revolver is a sort of fascinating place to start with them, especially then because you're going to be able to go on and experience that that insane growth from there creatively, and then also have the opportunity to look back, like you say, to some of that early material that's repackaged into Meet the Beatles in America and stuff like that. So that's fascinating, and they've obviously stayed with you because they're a key feature of your book. They're one of your headline characters in this book.
They motivated the book. So the Beatles are the basis of the book. The Journal of Beatles Studies is the patron saint of the book. John, Paul, Ringo, and George are the main heroes of the book. Everything in the book comes from the Beatles. And I read a lot about the Beatles over the years, and learning that they almost gave up and that they couldn't get a record deal, and the incredible tale of their own near failure. That's basically what the book is grounded on.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll mention that more than once in this chat, but this current series that we've been doing of the podcast, where we look at all the number ones from in the UK in the 60s, and I've been breaking down the sort of Beatles story that goes alongside that, even before they were recording artists, and the amount of occasions we've said to each other, that could have been it. That could have been the point where the car broke down. Literally, it could have been the point where the car broke down and they never got to the next gig. They could have been disheartened after driving to Aldershot and playing to 18 people. You know, all these insane sort of specific moments are fascinating. So, yeah, it's a case study for the ages, definitely, I would have said.
Yeah, completely. And there's a general lesson. The Beatles' own near failures are of enduring fascination. But there's a general lesson for Taylor Swift, for Jane Austen, even for William Shakespeare and Steve Jobs. So success and failure and fame and obscurity, they often turn on something very small.
Indeed. And I, just before I hand to Gary, sorry, Gary, I jumped in there again. Just because I saw it in the news this week, obviously one of the big things with the Beatles is in 1964, they occupy the top five spaces in the Billboard Hot 100. They have something like 12 across the whole 100. Of course, Taylor Swift occupies at the moment the top 14 of the Billboard Hot 100.
Wow.
Which is an astonishing feat. Naysayers, I'm sure, will say it's because of the difference in how people access stuff, and to some extent it is, but she's on her way to breaking probably all the records that most of our big names hold.
Well, Taylor Swift, I think, is amazing. I think she deserves the spectacular success she's gotten. But the fact that she has so many records that are successful isn't just that all the records are really good, as they, I think, are, but also success breeds success. So if you love Taylor Swift, you'll love more Taylor Swift. And even if the Taylor Swift that you encounter isn't quite as great as the Taylor Swift that you initially loved, it's Taylor. It's more Taylor. And that's a little like, you know, people who like Stephen King, the novelist, or people who are obsessed with John Keats, the poet. They want more and more and more. And it might be there's some John Keats, the poet, that isn't quite so fantastic, but that people want to read their favorite. And so there's a kind of building on itself, multiplied by a very large number, that helps account for Taylor's spectacular record-breaking growth.
Mm. And she's certainly doing it by the numbers this time, isn't it? I think she's heralding the return of the album. I think that's something I've been reading about. Was it something like 31 songs she's released on this latest record? So something. She's, you know, something. And as her fans now, you ingest those. So each song has the potential to be in the charts now. You don't have to nominate one as a single and one as an album. So that's, and I think she's going to probably start a new trend now of people releasing albums, which I think is great, because I think the album's a great medium.
Completely. And I think it's cool to go back and forth between individuals like Taylor, or the Beatles, and general things about humanity. I think that's really fun. So to think, for example, of Connie Converse, we mentioned before, who never really made it in her lifetime, who could have been kind of Taylor Swift maybe, and maybe in a way is a little bit Taylor Swift now, long after her lifetime. And there are people all around who are amazing at something or other, who didn't get Brian Epstein or didn't get George Martin, or the equivalent of that. That's interesting. And I think it's kind of both tragic for many, but also inspiring about, people where we pass on the street.
That segues quite nicely into what I wanted to kind of start off with a bit, was that obviously throughout your book, you pull out these components of success and fame and these mechanisms which seem to contribute to those lucky few who make it. In the spirit of our podcast, where we tend to sort things, well, I do anyway, it may be a bit arbitrary, but what do you think are the top two or three kind of mechanisms really that seem to set aside those people who make it, especially super big, like some of the people we're talking about?
Okay, so I'll say something a little counterintuitive, which is the things that lead to the success of, for example, Jane Austen or the Beatles or Taylor Swift, the one or two have nothing to do with them. They're what happened to them rather than what they did. Mm. And I'd say the two things are informational cascades and group polarization. And for the Mona Lisa, let's just use the Mona Lisa as a case, a less provocative case maybe. The Mona Lisa wasn't so famous for a long, long time. It wasn't thought to be the greatest painting in the world, but something happened to it, which is it got stolen from Louvre. My French accent, apologies for it, isn't unbelievably good. And when it got stolen, there was a cascade of attention focused on it. where people said the Mona Lisa got stolen. What is the Mona Lisa? Oh, it's this incredible painting. It is so mysterious. And she, her eyes follow you wherever you go. And then it cascaded from one person to another, a little like what's happened to Taylor Swift, and certainly like what happened to Hamlet. And then after a relatively short period, the Mona Lisa became the Mona Lisa. That's the cascade of information going from one person to another, such that a name or a work of art or I want to hold your hand, that's just the thing. Group polarization is when people who are communicating with each other stir each other up to, let's call it a form of a mania or a kind of frenzy. And there was Obama mania, where Obama, for whom I worked, he's, in my view, great. He's amazing. But I'm drawing attention to what happened to him, not happened, not what he did. And I'm giving, a unexpected answer to your question, because the expected answer would be to say, the first thing is originality, and the second thing is persistence. And I'm saying, no. There are a lot of people who are really original and who are really persistent, who never make it. Now, yeah. Originality and persistence are important. So on the list of things that produce fame, originality and important and persistence count. But I'm putting informational cascades and group polarization above them because they are demonstrably associated with spectacular success and fame. Swifties, Beatlemania, clubs that are either denominated clubs or that function like clubs for Marvel Comics, or Bob Dylan has people who just are focused Dylan. I'm kind of one of them. And that's not because of Dylan's creativity and his persistence. It's about people doing things external to Dylan.
So I think, if you have the information informational cascade and the group polarization, and you have the originality and the staying power, you're really onto a winner then if you put all those things together.
That's right. So if you have no persistence, you might give up early, and you might be lost to history, even though you had a really, really good year, let's say. And if you are, let's say, persistent, but not that original, and benefit from cascade and effects and polarization, you might be the Dave Clark Five. I like the Dave Clark Five, but do they have the kind of originality of the Beatles? Sorry, Mr. Clark, no.
It's funny that we've just covered them in our last episode, their first entry into the UK charts, which is Glad All Over.
Yes.
And that was kind of my feeling at the time.
They're good. So Catch Me As If You Can is really good. Glad All Over is really good. They have a lot of good songs, but they're not original like the Beatles and like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. And certainly a lot of their fame came from their I'm trying not to say following on the coattails, but their exposure in America, where they were arguably bigger than they ever were in the UK. And that was a circumstance into which the Dave Clark Five found themselves, where it was kind of nobody could get enough of British things at the time. And it suited them well. And Dave Clark Five, whatever you might think of his drumming ability, is a phenomenal businessman.
Yeah, I'm a fan, I should say, of the Dave Clark Five. The only thing to say is there's a category of people who benefit from cascade effects and also from group polarization, who have persistence. Maybe that's related to business acumen, but they don't have incredible creativity. And they, you know, they'll make it, and they might make it into the history books, but maybe not. And, you know, you can take your pick in the history of music or poetry or novels of people who fall in that category.
Yeah, I mean, I could very easily go off on a tangent about writers here. So you mentioned Stephen King. Stephen King's a big fan of one of my all-time favourite writers, which is Ed McBain. A name at one point was huge and wrote 55 books in one series, hundreds of books. And who's...
Wow.
But his legacy seems to have totally dropped away, despite having champions like Stephen King, who will mention him whenever he gets the opportunity, to someone who sold hundreds of millions of books. You know, I mean, a lot of books. I don't know if it's hundreds of millions, but it's certainly a lot. He's one of the all-time great sellers. Legacy, that's always an interesting thing. How do some people that big and then not last? Like Stephen King is always going to last. He's going to be known forever.
Hope so. I love him. Okay, let's maybe get a little fussy here. So if you look at business books or other books on fame and success, here's what they tend to do. They ask, what are the shared characteristics of the spectacularly successful? And it might be that in music, there are five things that unifies, let's say, Taylor Swift, Bob Dylan, Selena Gomez, Beyonce, Kanye West, and they all share something. Or you might find in business among CEOs who are super successful, the 20 most successful all have, you know, unhappy childhoods and struggled in high school, and maybe they all were rejected by a boyfriend or girlfriend, and they shared all that. Or you can play the same game for politicians. We can see Margaret Thatcher and Barack Obama and Donald Trump and Churchill. They all had five things in common. Okay, I want to say, and this is one of the themes of the book, that that's junk science. And the reason it's junk science is that the characteristics shared by the people who did super well is inevitably going to be shared by people you've never heard of. So to say that, let's say, an unhappy childhood or struggle in high school is causally associated with fame and success is unproved and probably false, because the number of people who had those same things is really high and you never heard of them. So the human mind loves causal stories where we think, you know, Taylor Swift or Star Wars or something, there's something about them that connects with their time, or there's something in the character of Ms. Swift or George Lucas of Star Wars that is the same, and that's what made them super successful. No, it's 1,001 other things which are typically external to the person who did well, which is not to diminish the person who did well. They're amazing, 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 amazing. But it is to say that the actual causal story has about 29,000 things in it, some of which we'll never know, and 28,750 of which, let's say, have nothing to do with the person. It's something to do with the fact that there was a big snowstorm in the UK on the night of the televised performance of Please Please Me. The biggest snowstorm in about 100 years. People were staying home. They saw the Beatles. How did Please Please Me get to be number one? Well, that is a big reason. People were home because of the snow, and they saw the group. If they hadn't stayed home, then they wouldn't have been watching television.
Yeah, so like we say, so many things, so many. But yeah, moving back to the Beatles then. So like I say, we've been going through these UK number one singles, and people have cropped up like Dave Clark and a few names that really haven't had much of a legacy, but we know most of them. But the Beatles arrive in 1963 in the UK, certainly. And they're not the first stars or hit makers to come out of Liverpool, but it does certainly seem to be this notion of a powder keg, and that they explode. But they explode alongside Jerry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer with the Dakotas and Cilla Black and the Searchers and the Foremost, you know, all these names. You could go on and on. But does fame have a limited envelope in those sort of situations? Was it inevitable that only one band was going to really become the big thing? In a way, in a sense, is there only so much stardust?
That's such a great question. And I'm thinking, what was going on in Liverpool at the time, such that there was so much happening? A little like Vienna, when it was producing so many academic-ish types, or Chicago when I was there, when the economists and the economically inclined law professors were all focused and kind of stirring each other up, and Bloomsbury. So Liverpool's kind of like that for music. That's super interesting. I think on the one, there's something that I struggle with the math, because I struggle with math, called a power law. So there's a bell curve, which looks like this, like a bell. I'm making a little bell graphic with my finger, but just think of a bell. That's a normal distribution, as it's called. A power law distribution has tremendous success at the top, and then it declines, and then there's kind of a bunch of people who are doing terribly. So height is normally distributed. It's like a bell curve. Cultural products follow a power law distribution, where the big sellers, Taylor Swift, Stephen King, are at the top, and then the little sellers, Cass Sunstein, other law professors, were kind of way at the bottom. And the power law distribution has that characteristic. And I'd say that what you describe is a power law distribution with respect to musical acts. And it's not necessarily because one is fantastic and the others are just pretty good. I think that's probably true. Sorry, Jerry and the Pacemakers, I really like them. I think it's because of how public attention works. So if you look at books, they follow a power law distribution, where Harlan Coben, who's a very successful mystery writer and fantastic, he sells toward the top, at least in the United States. He almost always is number one on the bestseller list. And there are others. I'm a big fan of Harlan Coben, so I hesitate to say they're as good as he is, but there are at least two people who are in his league. There must be, about whom we've never heard, because they didn't get the cascade effects that he got. And I think probably something like that is the right story for what happened in Liverpool. But I hesitate to be confident of that because I like the Beatles so much. And the other ones you mentioned, I like them all, but I think the Beatles had genius. Now, my focus on that departs from my story. I mean, so maybe we talk just for a moment about that. We can more later if you like. Mm-hmm. The idea that Lennon and McCartney discovered each other or in the same group, I mean, how should we even think about that? They're both off the charts. They're completely off the charts. So I really like the Dave Clark Five. I really, 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 really like the Rolling Stones. But McCartney and Lennon, what kind of league are they in? Now, how do we think about that?
Well, that kind of leads a bit to the next question is, do you think that the Beatles, with the unique combination of Lennon and McCartney, the powder keg kind of effect of what they came out of and the trajectory they sustained, do you think they are kind of unique in their level of fame up until now? Of course, I mean, we don't, who knows about the future, but I mean, they've set a bar that, because everyone has to compare themselves back to them, they almost redefine rules because they are this huge phenomenon.
Yeah, this is such a great question. So one question to ask is, are they unique in the sense that they are genuinely a cut above anybody else? And I don't want to deny that. I mean, who does Dylan rival them? I think so. My own view is that he also has genius. Does anyone else rival them? I don't know. There's taste can be argued about. Taylor Swift is fantastic. Is she as good as the Beatles? Not yet. Not nearly yet. And I say that as a big Taylor Swift fan. So there's that. Then there's just their, independent of their quality, there's their cultural salience. And that is connected with their amazingness. But if what I'm saying makes any sense, their amazingness isn't a necessary condition for that. So you could have someone else who would occupy that space. They suppose they hadn't gotten record deal. Suppose that on those fateful days, things had fallen apart. Then, you know, then would we be talking about the Rolling Stones? Maybe, but were the Rolling Stones the Rolling Stones because of the Beatles? So this is, it's very hard to think what the world would look like without them. A part of their uniqueness, it's a little like Shakespeare, I think, who, you know, words fail for his amazingness, but also he has a kind of cultural salience that is connected with his amazingness, but not a necessary product of his amazingness. I think we also want to say about the Beatles that as great as they were early, they had joy and effervescence and irresistibility and magic, but they weren't the Beatles. They weren't genius. Love Me Do is really good. So is, you know, Take Your Pick, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You. These are really good. They have a kind of, bubble is too light a word, but they kind of have a magnetism, but they're not genius. And so the genius flowered by virtue of the fact that they had a lot of room because everyone loved them. And people would say, okay, team, see what you can do. And they thought, well, let's see what we can do. And they also had, unlike some, I think this is true of many UK groups whom I really like. Herman's Hermits is another. An American group I really like is the Love and Spoonful. I think both of these are terrific, but they didn't have the desire to outdo themselves in the way the Beatles did. Maybe that's part of their uniqueness. And I think this is, you know, shall we compare the Beatles to Shakespeare? Shall we compare thee to a summer's day? Yes, let's go there. Shakespeare outdid himself. He would do, you know, the most amazing historical dramas, and then he'd do romances and comedies and tragedies. I mean, who does that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think their ability, well, their desire to reinvent themselves with every passing album and to come back and to push themselves, and the fact that that worked every time. I suppose if they'd have done that and they'd really hit a sour note, and their story might have gone so far, but they just seemed to keep on elevating and elevating and elevating with their musical creativity and genius, but also keep the imaginations of the people going along with them. And I think in centuries to come, we will still be talking about the Beatles and Shakespeare, especially with the fact that the Beatles were perhaps the first huge act to come out of the media age as well. So we will have everything that they've ever done in whatever format we'll be watching in 200 years' time. And so maybe they will sustain for a lot longer than some of these people who do get forgotten.
Yeah, I think that's right. Partly because of the intrinsic factors to which you point, but partly because also of their cultural salience, because of the social effects that are captured in the word Beatlemania. So, you know, Keats has a salience. Keats is in the canon, but he died at the age of 25, thinking, he was very ambitious, Keats was, thinking that he had failed. And so his tombstone says something like, he whose name was writ in water, which was a tribute to his own sense that he was ephemeral. He was wrong about that.
That is fascinating. I did not know that about Keats, having studied him at A level.
Did you do him as well, Gary? I did.
Yes, yeah.
Until we went to the same school. They didn't change you did the Keats, syllabus. Whatever. Yeah.
But they didn't mention that, did they? It's another, Van Gogh's another example, isn't he? Someone who went in his lifetime, didn't really think anyone was bothered, and such a shame in a way not to know. And you do cover a lot of people about how people get rediscovered or reevaluated later down the line. That obviously doesn't need to apply to the Beatles, but it tells us something about this whole ethereal nature of fame and,
completely. So Robert Johnson, who is now regarded maybe as the creator of the blues or maybe the greatest blues artist ever, who had a a massive impact on Eric Clapton and Bob Dylan and many others. Robert Johnson died with only 20 odd songs recorded and completely unknown. And then kind of luckily he got a record decades after he lived, and people thought, my gosh, who was this person? And did he make a deal with the devil? So there are a bunch of books about Robert Johnson that have the word "the crossroads." And the thought was his genius came from Satan saying, I'm going to give you something no one's ever had, and I'm going to take your soul. And I don't believe that happened. But the fact that it's the basis for at least five, and I think significantly more books about Robert Johnson, attests to the genius that people now, I think rightly, think he had, but he would have been astounded.
Yeah. There's part of, because I'm a bit soppy, a bit emotional. I mean, I start thinking about all the missed people, the people who may have missed opportunities. It gets me quite straight in the heart, which is why to find something like Connie Converse cropping up and then finding at least now we can hear something, it's still... What I'm dreaming of is that she would have been 100 years old this year, it seems, from looking into her. Amazing if she suddenly just turned up and went, here I am.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, thank you for that. So as I started the book, it was inspired by the Beatles narrative, with a sense that the circumstances that produce fame are external to the amazingness of the people who get famous. And I was motivated partly, I worked for President Obama, and at one point I went to dinner at the residence. I knew him from the University of Chicago, and he just was kind of free associating. And he said, CEOs, you know, the corporate bigwigs, think I hate them. And he said, I don't hate them at all. I like them. He said, but one thing I do know is that the fact that they're CEOs is a product of a bunch of strokes of luck, which is not to diminish how fantastic they are. He said, I'm president and I hope I'm doing a good job, but how did I get to be president? A bunch of things had to break for me. And he said, some of the CEOs don't sufficiently appreciate that. And that point became the kind of the moral heart of the book. So I didn't want it to be in any way a political book. I wanted it to be a book about culture and the wellsprings of fame and success. But just to your point, the book gets quite emotional about astounding people who have been lost to history and maybe will be recovered. Connie Converse is the hero of the book alongside the Beatles. And that's, I think that's, you know, I like that, that she who's been lost and was great can stand alongside the Beatles as the hero of a book. And also that there are people all around us who could be amazing at one thing or another. Maybe they didn't get a chance. I mean, Muhammad Ali, the greatest boxer, one of my heroes, how did he become a boxer? Well, his bicycle got stolen when he was 12. He went up to the police officer nearby and said, I'm going to whoop that guy. He stole my bicycle. And the police officer said, well, if you're going to whoop somebody, you better learn to box. And, you know, Ali didn't know what that was even about. But the guy who said that, the police officer, happened to have a boxing gym. I mean, how lucky was that? And he said, okay, Cassius, his name was Cassius Clay. He said, let me teach you how to box. If the bicycle hadn't been stolen, would Muhammad Ali have become a boxer? It's hard to see how.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Who's the most famous person in the world now? That's one question that comes out that I was, you know, in terms of you, when you're thinking in sort of really abstract terms, who is the most famous person in the world now? Who is the most famous person in the world ever? That's, you know, I like the fact this could go down to like little individual stories and also make you think about sort of those questions as well.
I mean, this is knowable, yes. I mean, whether it's known is unclear, but it's knowable. You'd have to ask every person in the world or a sufficiently random sample, mm-hmm. Have you heard of XYZ? And I have a parochial thought about English-speaking countries, yes. But I read that China's got a lot of people in it, and who's famous there would be not the same as who's famous in Ireland. So I don't have a prediction about who's the most famous person in the world. But I think the Pope is pretty famous.
Yeah, he's got it going on, I think. He does all right, status-wise.
Taylor's pretty famous.
Yeah, yeah. And I will stop myself from going down the route of talking about, say, like you mentioned there, it's the English-speaking world versus the rest of the world. Mm. You have Bollywood superstars who are insanely massive stars to a huge number of people and outsell many of our biggest ever-selling artists in the West, essentially, who we rarely hear about. And so there's ways of applying these studies and the way you've chosen to look at it across different places if people choose to do so.
Yeah, that's very cool. And part of the reason it's cool is the cultural difference that someone might be famous in India and not at all in the UK. Part of it is that there are people who could be famous anywhere who are super famous in some places, but not so much in others. Like there's a movie from a number of years ago, not that old, called Searching for Sugarman, where there was a musician named Sisto Rodriguez, you may know the name, mm-hmm. who was huge in South Africa and kind of unknown in the UK and the United States. And how did he become so big in South Africa? Well, one reason might be he really spoke to the conditions of apartheid and its aftermath. I think that's not right. I think that he got the equivalent of early popularity, and then things really took off, and in South Africa, but not elsewhere. It's not about the culture. It's about the lottery. Life's lottery.
Hmm. I've always loved that idea as a musician myself, and that one day I'll find out there's some obscure country where I've been number one for the last 20 years and no one ever told me about it.
Don't you know? I'm speaking in Massachusetts. You're huge in Massachusetts.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, when I visited, Gary, your picture was on billboards everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I went to the ball game, they played your stuff on the organ beforehand.
Completely.
Just no one decided to tell me, that's all.
Yeah.
No, it's fascinating. And I suppose it's also worth kind of just, I mean, we talk about fame there as being empirical, something you can measure basically by being known to people. I mean, is that a simpler definition as you think it entails? Is fame and success, are they two sides of the same thing, or
great. So let's say that I'm speaking at Harvard Law School. There's a professor named Frank Michelman, who is super successful. For a number of years, he was as admired as any law professor in the United States. He placed his articles in the most distinguished journals. His students admired him, his colleagues admired him. He's retired now, he's emeritus, but he's very, very successful. Is he famous? No. I mean, the number of people who've heard the name Frank Michelman is not that high, but he's super successful. There are people in business who have $1 trillion and who run entities of some size that you've never heard of. I happened to come across, just through various things, someone who runs a very, very large American company and is super successful. I'd never heard of him. So you could be famous. I gather there are a lot who are really well known, but who are by some measures not successful. That is, they're not economically comfortable. They're struggling in multiple ways. Success, of course, you could define as having a life you like, and that need have no association with fame. If you define success as rising to the top of your profession, you can do that and not be at all famous.
Mm. Yeah, so they aren't they don't necessarily come together, but in the biggest examples of fame, they generally come hand in hand. Like the Beatles. They've got it all, haven't they? The fame and the success.
Yes, I was watching something recently about some actor who was super famous, who had serious economic troubles at almost all stages, and but someone who was in movies and television, but who just didn't make it economically. This is someone from not like the last 10 years, but the last 30 years. And it's puzzling how that could happen. But if you are in three really big movies, let's say, and one really big TV series, you might not make enough money to sustain yourself over a period of 25 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the common misconception, isn't it, with actors and people in the public eye often, is that they, because you know them, that they must therefore be set up for life, or and quite often they aren't, especially I think in the world of like stand-up comedians, and they have to work very hard to maintain an income, even if they do appear on the TV every now and again, or, you know, so, yeah, it's not everything, just the fame, but it's a fascinating subject. Paul, have you got anything else you want to ask Cass?
Should we try a quickfire Beatles question here? You've mentioned a few albums you like. I know I put you on the spot last year with McCartney songs. Let's try a favourite Lennon song.
You've Got to Hide Your Love Away.
Super.
Yeah. That's not surprising with your Dylan. How much you like Dylan as well? Because that's Lennon trying his hand at Dylan, isn't it? Really.
Yeah, though it has its own kind of Lennon-esque ethos. I think Dylan would like to say it's Dylan and it's clearly influenced, but I think it's sounds like Lennon's sensibility, not Dylan's.
No, he's obviously made it his own, but it's great. I mean, that's part of their genius, is that they were absorbing everything, and this is the thing we talk about this. Wave they cut through the kind of the world of music and everything, but actually they were taking as much in as they were putting out there, and completely. Must be causing some crazy feedback loop that kind of kept on pushing them forwards. Well, I just want to say thanks again for joining us. Good luck with the book. When does it actually come out? Is it out? I know it's coming in May, isn't it?
May 21st.
May 21st.
That's an international holiday. It's called How to Become Famous Day. And it's the one thing that's celebrated both in Ukraine and Russia, How to Become Famous Day.
It'll hopefully unite the world.
Great. Great to see you both. Thanks for
doing this. Lovely talking to you, Cass.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ta-ra.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.